alcoholic. Well, what an exciting weekend this has been. I just want to take a moment to thank my friend Fred, who brought my name to the attention of the committee down here, and I want to thank Clark for the invitation to come, and I definitely would like to take a moment to recognize all of the people that have put this on, the ladies that are working really hard in the kitchen right now. Maybe we could give them a hand of applause. Thank them for everything. Awesome. Thank you so much. You know, this morning I woke up the same way I have every day for the last 5.5 years, in the grips of a hopeless, helpless disease that could only have that moment of being recovered or recovering, whichever you prefer, with a conscious contact to a higher power. And I can't have that when I'm sleeping. You know, it says in the big book that there'll come a day when the alcoholic will forget with sufficient force the exact force of their last drunk, and they'll drink again. It's one of my biggest fears to drink again. So in that moment when I first wake up, I remember what it was like 5.5 years ago when I woke up. This fear that I said to my family what I thought I said, the remorse, the guilt, the loneliness, the shame, the absolute bewilderment of how I could have done it again, because that morning I swore off that I wasn't going to drink, and here I was once again. And you know, by taking that few moments, I get right on my knees and I ask God for help. And I work the first 3 steps of this program, and remember, I can't, He can, and I will let Him. Get ready for my day, and right in my bathroom over the mirror, there's a sign, and it says, I'm not lucky, I'm blessed. And that reminds me, you know what? Luck implies that I had something to do with this, and I didn't. The only thing that I did really well on my own was get drunk. But I'm blessed because having that connection to a higher power, I get to live today, and I only have today. You know, I like to say I fly by the seat of my God pants because I don't know what the hell I'm supposed to be doing, honestly. I just do the next indicated thing. And it works out incredibly well. And, you know, being an alcoholic, I get that big head, and every once in a while, you know, I like to try to do it my way, and it gets really, really uncomfortable. And that's the beauty of the programs. We're reminded often that all we have to do is stop and make that spiritual connection, and life continues the way that it's supposed to. I like to share that because I only have today. That's how my day has gone today, and it's been a true blessing. That's not how it was 5.5 years ago. 5.5 years ago, you know, we talk about in the big book that we become delusional. I'm the biggest case of delusional you could ever meet. I have been drinking for years. I drank the first time when I was 19. I will never forget, most likely, that ease and comfort that came from that first drink. You know, for the first time, I got along, I fit in, everybody liked me, I was funny, life was great. Spent 30 years chasing that feeling again, and it never came. You know, for probably about the last year of my drinking, I had been, you know, crying at night and convincing myself that, you know what, I needed to drink so I could get my emotions out because I had them all bottled up, you know, and I had to have that drink. And, you know, then I get sometimes, like I wanted to stop and I'd call the 800 AA hotline, and when they asked me if I wanted help, I'd hang up and then like wait to see if they're going to come find me, you know, and they never did. And, you know, and then I'd wake up in the morning and I'd get going. I wasn't ever going to drink again, and I was fine and life was great. And, you know, by the end of the day, I was drinking again, you know, but I could convince myself I was fine. I was a functioning alcoholic. I had a job. I got there in time. I did it. I got a paycheck. I couldn't be an alcoholic, but amazingly, I kept going back to that AA website and looking at that. So 5.5 years ago in May of 2013, I woke up, and you know what? I was just done. I was done. I was sick and tired of this feeling. I wasn't going to do it anymore. I didn't know anything about AA, but I knew that's where you went if you wanted to quit drinking. I was a drunk. I looked at the meeting list. There was a meeting at noon. It was at Bridge Street Drunks. I needed to go there because I was a drunk. It was really convenient because it was at noon. I'm sure you all understand how important I am. I have lots of things to do that fit into my schedule. And so at 7 o'clock in the morning, I was really set that's where I needed to go. By noon, when that meeting time came around, I'm driving over there. It's on the north side of Isaiah. It's a little shady on the north side of Isaiah. My dad had been a cop for 25 years there. We weren't supposed to go on the north side. You know, my first thought is, well, you know, I'm up on the north side of Isaiah. I probably shouldn't be here. My dad would get mad. And 47 freaking years old and he lives in another state. Who cares, right? So I drive up to this meeting. It is on the north side. It's in a garage next to a house. And I drive up there and there's a table sitting out there and they're surrounded by little old men smoking cigarettes. And I'm like, you know, I don't know much about AA, but I think you have to share. And there's no way these people can understand me. So I drove away and, you know, my next best thinking was to go to the Alana Club in Visalia. It's also on the pretty cheesy side of town. Ironically, right next to a liquor store, so I haven't figured that one out. But so I drive over to the Alana Club because they have a name meeting also. And I drive up out there and there's some guys with, you know, the hanging pants and the long chains and tattoos. And they're walking in there and I'm like, you know, I used to work in law enforcement too and some of them might know me. So I probably shouldn't go in there. Something about that, I was a police dispatcher. Nobody saw me. They only heard me. They would have never known me. You know, by the time that I got back to work and I made it to a meeting, I was starting to really question, did I even really need to go? Because from what I saw out there, I wasn't going to fit in anywhere. But there was this inner voice that said I needed to go to a meeting still, so I looked on the meeting list. There was a women's meeting that night. It was at the Trinity Church in Visalia. It's a spinoff of Christian Reform, and I grew up in the Christian Reform Church, so that worked out great. Amazingly, by 7 o'clock, I was not even really that bad. I walked in there, there's a big old group of women sitting around, you know, they're laughing and talking and they're telling their stories and they asked if there was anybody that was new there and of course I stood up, I got my 24-hour tip, I was all super proud, you know, I made it that long, I had a drink and, you know, as I listened to their stories, there was nothing that I could identify with at all. Absolutely nothing. By the time I left, I was so grateful they had a place to go because they were messed up. And that was fine. And, you know, I got all the way home before I drank my bottle of alcohol. And I remembered hearing at that meeting, progress, not perfection. That was progress. This might work, you know. Went on in the next day, I ended up drinking again, you know, and I'd end up now, I'm crying about they're going to come take their 24-hour tip. I didn't deserve that, you know, and the lady bought me the big book. This is very important to all of you people that buy big books for newcomers. They need to read them. She never told me to read it. It's her fault. She bought it for me, gave it to me, then told me to read it. Kept drinking, went back the next week to that meeting, still couldn't figure it out, you know. I still wasn't as bad as all them, went home again, you know. Went back the third week. Holy cow, this stuff is starting to work. Now I'm making it like 3 days, you know, 3 days, not drinking. I'm figuring this out, you know. And about the third day, I start getting a little shaky and, you know, I was thinking, well, they talked about calling people, and I haven't told anybody, so that's probably what I needed to do. Didn't call the lady with 20 years of sobriety that bought me the big book. I called the one that was struggling and thinking about drinking. Because after all, I hadn't drank in 3 days, you know, and I could probably help her. So I called her up, and, you know, she's telling me all of her story and what's going on, and, you know, I tell her with the sincerity that I met from the bottom of my heart. I don't know why you would want to drink. I haven't drank in 3 whole days, and my life is fantastic. And she told me, she says, "That's you're in a pink cloud. You're going to fall off. Don't worry about it." So I did. Went ahead and drank. You know, might as well get it over with. And so then my next best thinking, we're about 4 weeks into this now, you know, was the problem was I was on a Tuesday night, and I had to go through the weekend to get back to the Tuesday night. So if I went to a meeting on Friday at noon, I could probably make it through the weekend. So I bucked up, drove up in my super cool car because I had one at the time, from my job, which I had that too, you know, so I probably wasn't that bad, to the Alana Club at noon. I was going to brave it, so I want to do this. Clutched in my purse, walked up in there, sat down, looking around, a little bit scared, you know, and so they start the meeting, and they pass the basket around. Now, what the secretary said was, "I sent the basket around. There's a lot of people in this meeting, and we don't have enough money to pay the rent. I'm going to pass the basket around again, and possibly some of you that have a job to put a little more in to help the people that don't." What I heard was, you need to put all your money in this basket because you obviously have a job and you could support all of us. That's what I heard. So, of course, I was offended. I'm sure you would have been, too. So I got up and I flounced out and I was like, stupid Emma, that's a rhyme, just like that. You know, I'm so grateful for that happening because I went on the worst drunk I'd ever been on in my life. You know, I got drunk on the way home. I stayed drunk all of Saturday, barely woke up at all. I did stay dry on Sunday because I had to go out of town. I had my son be my little policeman. I couldn't go into a store unless he went with me, so I wouldn't buy any alcohol. Made it to Monday. My best thinking at the time, because I was starting to drink and drive a whole lot, was to go buy my alcohol before I went to work. Come home. Of course, you have to drink a little bit. I'm sure you all know that, because if you put it in the freezer, it might expand and explode. It can't be wasting alcohol. So, you know, then I'd put it in the freezer, and that way it would be there when I got home. Thus, I was not drunk driving. Seemed perfect. Well, on Monday, I was running a little bit late, which is also stupid because I didn't punch a time clock, but just so you know where I was at. Couldn't make it to the liquor store to buy that alcohol and make it home, so I went ahead and took it with me to work. I was about a 10-mile drive to work. I drank half a pint of Jack Daniels on my way to work. Put it in a brown paper bag in the freezer. We did have alcohol in the freezer at my job because sometimes we'd have clients in and it was appropriate, so nobody would have paid attention. And, you know, I started my job, and, you know, that crazy thing was my brain kept thinking, well, you know, that alcohol's in the freezer. It might explode. Did you really drink enough? You know, so my best thinking was I might as well go ahead and drink it because then I could, you know, apply myself at work and get it done. So I did. I went and drank that last half of that pint of Jack Daniels, and not really sure what all happened after that. You know, about 10:30, I was in the parking lot, going to go home, crying. My boss happened to pull up and asked me if I needed a ride home. I said, oh, no, absolutely not. I'm fine. It's just everybody else. You know, you just don't understand all the crazy stuff going on in my life. I'm good. You know, I'm not really sure how I got home. I'm assuming I drove on the 99 freeway, which is the way that I always drove home. I remember bits and pieces, walked in the house about 11 o'clock, passed out. Woke up at 1 o'clock, bewildered. Did not know how that could have happened. Just crazy. You know, and then I thought, holy crap, you know what, I might not have a job. If I don't have a job, then I might be an alcoholic, and I know I'm not an alcoholic, so I better make sure I have a job. So I called my boss, he didn't answer, I stressed, walked around a little bit longer, called him again, and you know, he answered the phone, and you know, I start my normal little tirade, you know, I don't know what happened, you know, and he's like, I know what happened, you showed up drunk from work from last night. For the first time in my life, I kept my mouth shut and didn't correct him that I got drunk that morning, you know, which was probably a good thing. But, you know, he told me, he said, look, you know what, I don't care what's going on in your life. He said, you need to pull your head out of your ass. I need you at work. Tell me what it is you need right now, and I will do whatever I can to help you. And this is your one shot. So I said, you know what, I'm fine. I'll be there tomorrow morning. And he's like, are you sure? You're sure that's what you need because this is your one shot? And I said, yes, that's all I need. I'll be there tomorrow morning. Hung up the phone. First thought that went through my brain was, I can go ahead and drink the rest of today because I don't have to be there till tomorrow morning, right? So I was like, holy cow, I am insane. Alcohol has absolutely, positively made me insane. I called that lady that bought me the big book of 20 years of sobriety. She agreed to meet me for dinner. So we went to eat dinner, you know, and bless her little pea-picking heart. She listened to my crybaby, you know, sad story of what was going on in my life. And I'm trying to choke down dinner, you know, wanting to vomit the whole time and act okay. And, you know, then she tells me we're going to go to a meeting. She takes me to a meditation meeting of all things. You know, you got to sit still and be quiet for 10 minutes, you know. And I'm like, holy cow, you know. I made it, and I made it through there, and you know, I did hear one thing that I carry with me that's very important to me today, and I could see it tonight. A girl in that meeting said, I really like the part of the big book where it talks about people that wouldn't normally mix come together and they stay together. And you know, as I look around this room, there's not one person in here that I knew before today. And there's four people in here that I knew when I got here today, and they're absolute, positive, fabulous friends. The people I've met here during this weekend have been incredible. And you know what a gift that is, and I took that away from that. You know, so then after the meeting, you know, she was driving back to my car, and she says, well, you know, do you want me to be your sponsor? I'm like, well, yeah. She's like, well, you need to ask me. I'm like, okay, can you be my sponsor? And she's like, yep. And tomorrow night, we're going to go to the women's meeting, and Wednesday, I'm going to show up at your house, and we're going to start working the steps. And I'm like, hey. I said, what happened to Easy Does It? You know, that's like every night of the week. And she's like, no, that's what we're going to do. And I'm like, all right, whatever. So we went to the meeting on Tuesday, and Wednesday she came over, and, you know, she let me tell her some of my sad story again, you know, and she was not impressed in the least. It was horrifying, and I tried my best, you know. And so she made me a deal. She said, if you really think you want a drink, you call me up, and if you can convince me that we need to go have a drink, I'll go with you. I said, all right, you know. She said, the other thing is, now tomorrow I want you to call Rayanne. And I said, why would I call Rayanne? She said, it's Rayanne's birthday. You need to call Rayanne and tell her happy birthday. I'm like, I don't even think I like Rayanne. Why do I want to call her and tell her happy birthday? She says, you just need to call her. Just do it. I'm like, okay, whatever. You know, so the next day I went to call Rayanne, and I was hoping. She didn't answer the phone because I didn't want to talk to Rayanne, you know. I could just leave her a quick message, but, you know, she did answer the phone, and actually, you know what, that started my journey, and I understand today that importance of another alcoholic picking up when you need to talk to somebody. And Rayanne and I talked, I wished her happy birthday, and, you know, I started understanding. The women in that meeting were absolutely incredible, some of them, a lot of them I didn't like, didn't really want to be around, but a few of them I did like, and, you know, it was all about what I thought was important. So anyway, after about 3 or 4 days of not drinking, I was starting to realize that my biggest fear was happening. I didn't ever want to quit drinking because I was afraid I wouldn't be able to go to sleep. And I was having a hard time sleeping. And, you know, I was like, see, I knew this was going to happen. You know, it took about the fourth night after talking to Rayanne and starting to feel like, you know, maybe I'm not alone in this, that other people do understand me, I'm not so unique. I started realizing I had been staying awake those 3 nights trying to figure out a way to convince that 20-year sponsor that I needed to go get a drink. And it was exhausting me, you know, so I finally decided I'm not ever going to convince her, so I might as well just go to sleep. And, you know, after about the fifth day, I was like, you know, it's really difficult going that time from work to home, because that's when I'd stop and buy my alcohol if I didn't get it in the morning before I went to work. So I reached out to another lady in the program, and she said, maybe it would be helpful if you listen to speaker tapes while you're in the car. And I was like, oh, that's a good idea. So she gave me one, and you know what? It's been incredible. I still listen to him today. His name is Vern. He's a psychiatrist and an alcoholic, and he tells a story. Vern's from Kentucky. He has a southern draw. I can relate to a lot of it. My family came from the south, so it wasn't unusual to me. And, you know, Vern said a lot of things. I laughed with him. I cried with him. And he said at a point in his tape that he said, you know, if you're willing to do what we do and you're willing to try, there'll come a day when you never walk alone. And you can take that to the bank. And, you know, that's the first thing that I associated with somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to be alone. And I became willing. You know, I have a little different version of my story today because I have a little better understanding. I would have told you about 6 months ago that I kind of half-assed it with that sponsor because I would be reading everything like 3 or 4 hours right before I met with her. What I understand today is I couldn't remember stuff to save my life. So I had to read it like right before I met with her so that way I could discuss it intelligently because I was going to graduate from AA. I was going to do a very, very meticulous job at this. And I had to understand it so I can converse with her intelligently. You know, but I get over there and nothing I ever did impressed her. And I tried really, really hard, you know. And she'd tell me to call her and I didn't know what I was supposed to call her about. So I tried to think of something to talk about, you know. And she had a very, like, serious voice, too. So it was a little bit difficult, you know. And so we kept on with this. And, you know, I never could quite do exactly what she wanted me to do. I could never do it well enough, you know. And I did know, though, that she was going to make me go back and apologize to that secretary of that meeting that I saw him stand on that day. I just knew that was coming. So I was going to get some brownie points and do it before she told me. So I went back to the meeting, you know, on a Friday afternoon, and I was sitting there, and I'll never forget this little gal. She had been sober for a lot of years, and she was, like, really super tiny, and, you know, and she was, like, put her hands on the podium, and she's like, if you are willing to do what we do, you can be happy, joyous, and free. And I'm like, holy cow, I don't know I want to be any of that. You know, that was a little bit impressive, you know. But I made it through the meeting and got to the end, and I walked up to that secretary, and, you know, I'm giving him my heartfelt apology, you know, and telling him how he saved my life, and I'm really grateful to him, and I acted inappropriately. And the whole time he's standing there totally expressionless. You know, and I'm like pouring my heart out here. It was really difficult. And I get to the end, and he like grabs me in a big old hug and laughs right in my face. And he says, honey, I don't know who you are or what you're talking about, but just keep coming back. This will work. And I went, first person that told me to keep coming back. You know, this is pretty cool. So anyway, I was going to meetings, doing the best I could, reading stuff right before I got there, still not remembering stuff, but thinking I'm fine, I'm doing great, my life's getting better, I knew all the verbiage I was supposed to say, and I was spitting it out as fast as I could. And I was miserable. Absolutely positively miserable. Sponsor told me I needed to get a service commitment, so I was a greeter at the women's meeting for a while, and then I was getting close to 6 months sober, she told me that I needed to get another one. 6 months, put in close to about 5 months, 5.5 months. Thanksgiving's coming up for the first year because I got sober in June. Knew that I was going to need to go to a meeting, otherwise I was probably going to kill somebody at my house. So I only found the meeting that I could go to that day that I seriously only could go to was Bridge Street Drunks. And I'm like, well, you know what, I'm just going to own this. I'm going to just walk in there, sit down, make myself at home, and know I belong. And that's exactly what I did. And you know, the amazing thing was that place I couldn't go in when I first wanted to get sober was the place that I began to call home. It was a totally awesome meeting, had a great Thanksgiving, went back the next day because, you know what, it worked so well that day, I might as well go back again. And the most amazing thing happened, the man at that meeting on that Friday morning said, so, how long have you been sober? And I'm like, well, almost 6 months. They're like, cool. We need a secretary for the Friday morning meeting, and we think you should be it. And I'm like, hot damn, somebody's figuring out how good I'm getting this, you know? So I go back the next Friday, and I got my key, and I get in there and set everything up, and like 4 people showed up. They all wanted to go to the men's meeting that was down the road. That's why they needed a secretary for the Friday morning meeting. And I was perfect because I'm not a man, can't go to the men's meeting. So, you know, I honored this commitment. One of the things I always wanted to be was the person that showed up and did what they said they were going to do. And so I went to this meeting every week, and I tried really, really super hard at that meeting too. I was a secretary after all. I ought to be able to say something super smart, right? So I would, like, read my daily reflections in the morning before I got there, and I'd have a share all planned out in my head, and I'd get there, and they read something totally different. I had a total habit of reading the wrong day, you know, and I was like, no matter how hard I tried to be super smart, I just always ended up falling on my face, you know. And so after about 8 months, that sponsor, you know, she wasn't impressed by this service commitment at all, let me tell you. And I never was quite meeting her, you know, all the things she wanted me to do, because she had a lot of roles, and I didn't really like them so well. So I just quit calling her. It was just like a way easier thing to do. And I was going only to that Friday morning meeting, and that's all I did. And, you know, I fortunately, I didn't drink in that 6 months. I was working 85 hours a week. I really didn't have time to do much else than do that and go to that meeting. I wouldn't suggest it to anybody. It's not a great idea. It's very dangerous. But, you know, I was so delusional. It really didn't matter because I thought I was fine. And after about 6 months of doing that, it's like, you know, I probably need to get more into this program, because the one thing that happened in going on Friday mornings is that I started seeing that the people that were going to this meeting is right next to the mission in Visalia, so you have a lot of homeless people come in, people that everything that they own is in a bag. That's what they have when they come to that meeting. those people that I thought that I was so much better than had something that I didn't have. They had hope. Hope for change, hope for a different life, hope if they followed this program, their life would be better. And I didn't have any hope, and I wanted hope. So I was like, you know what, I need to get back into this program, and I called that sponsor and told her, you know what, I need to get back into this program, I'm willing to do everything you tell me to do. And I've got 3 more weeks in this commitment of working 85 hours a week, and as soon as that's over, I'll go to every meeting you tell me to go to, I will do everything you tell me to do, I just need that amount of time. And she's like, okay. So I did meet with her, I went to the meeting that we agreed I'd go to, I was keeping that commitment, and after about a week, she told me, well, you know what, you need to go to this meeting, you're not doing this, and all of that roles and all of that stuff started up again. And I told her, I said, you know what, I wouldn't be sober if it wasn't for you, and I will be eternally grateful, but I really think I need to be somewhere else, doing something else. And she said, okay. And so then I had like a moment of butt pucker, because I'm like, holy hell, now I got to get a new sponsor, and how am I going to do that, you know? And so my best thinking, go back to the women's meeting, you know? And when I went to the women's meetings in the beginning, you know, there were some women I mentioned just briefly that I didn't like, and there was this lady. She'd been sober a lot of years. Every time she opened her mouth, I didn't like her. Every time she looked my direction, I didn't like her. If she talked for too long, I hated her. And I did everything I could to stay away from her. But there was this inner voice that told me to be nice to her, which I didn't quite understand, but that's okay. You know what? I never was mean to her face, but I hated her in my mind. Absolutely positively hated her. So I got to this women's meeting. I just went like shopping for a sponsor, seeing what I could figure out, you know, and I'll be damned to heck. That's the woman that stood out in the parking lot with me for 2 hours talking to me. And I'm like, holy cow. And she said the most incredible thing. She said, you know, I think this program is working because you're finally starting to make sense. And I'm like, wow, you know what? Here's somebody that understands me. She probably needs to be my sponsor. So I invited her over to my house. We talked for a bit. I kind of hem-tawed around a little bit. And she says, is there something that you want to ask me? And I said, well, yeah, you know, I was wondering if you could be my sponsor. And she says, well, what is it you want out of sobriety? And I'm like, you know, this woman has almost 40 years of sobriety, and that's what she's asking me? Well, of course I don't want to drink. You know, and she's like, well, but what else do you want? And I'm like, I don't want to drink. And she says, well, how are you living life, you know? And I said, oh, yeah, I'm not very happy. I would like a different life, you know. And she says, well, I don't know that I really like the word sponsor, but, you know, maybe mentor. She says, you know, we can get together once a week. We can talk about the steps, how you apply them in your life, and, you know, you can call me. And then, you know, I think I was looking so hard for somebody to love me, and this lady had 40 years of sobriety, and believe me, she didn't get sober when she was 10, so, you know, she's a little bit more mature than me, and, you know, had a kind face, and I'll tell you what, that woman that I thought was going to be so kind and nice and stuff, she can pop her eyeballs out of her head, and it is frightening, absolutely positively frightening. So at that moment, she looked at me, and she said, but you need to understand, you are responsible for your own sobriety. I'm going to stay sober no matter what, and if you die, you die. And she got up and left. I was like, well, I'm not sure about this, you know. And so I decided I probably shouldn't call her either. And so I, you know, was going on about my business, and all of a sudden, once again, here I am, a year and a half not drinking, and I'm not sleeping again, and I couldn't really understand it. I'd get a couple hours here and there, and after about 3 days of that, you know, I thought, maybe I should read the big book, because I want to read the big book. So I got out the big book and read the first 164 pages over the next week or so, and I was amazed at how my story was on every page of the big book, and it started making sense to me. And after about a week and a half, I called that lady back, and she said, you know, I was a little bit worried about, you know, maybe I went too far when I told you if you die, you die. And I said, you told me if I die, I die? And she said, yeah, you didn't hear that? I said, oh, hell no, I was too afraid when you told me to be responsible. I didn't hear nothing else. I've never been responsible for anything in my life. place, you know? And so anyway, I started working with the sponsor, and I'm kind of doing what I was doing before. I was still being the secretary of that meeting. We were talking about the steps, how they work in our lives, things that were going on. It'd be like a 2 or 3 hour marathon every time we talked, and, you know, things weren't really changing. And, you know, now we're getting to the point I'm getting close to about 2 years sober at this point. And, you know, I was dating another him because I got rid of the first him. And, you know, there's always a him. There's got to be a him. And, you know, there's always problems with that. And, you know, I was all, like, stressed out about it one morning. And backed up just a little bit. I do have 2 children. My daughter's 28. My son is going to be 26. My son was born with a multi-medical condition. He's had 35 surgeries, 8 teams of doctors in San Francisco. We went about 8 to 10 times a year to deal with his medical. So kind of give you a little snapshot on that. You know, it was quite a journey with that. And he's very high-functioning, able to live on his own, take care of himself. Well, this morning in February, I was getting close to about 2 years sober. Life was going pretty good. I was a little bit upset about this him and everything. And get in my car, and there's a note taped to my steering wheel. And my son, the one that had 35 surgeries and was now doing well, told me that he thought he needed to be a girl and he was going to transition. Tell you what, those problems I got in the car with, they didn't seem so big anymore. And, you know, I was like, holy cow, how am I going to fix this? And what do I say to him? I mean, talk about being totally stressed. And, you know, the only thing I could think was, I think I need to go to a meeting. I really think I need to go to a meeting. And, you know, so I started going to meetings a little more regularly. And about 6 weeks after that, my uncle passed away. 6 weeks after that, my stepdad passed away. 6 weeks after that, my best friend's son, who had the same disability as my son, passed away. It was a crazy time during all of that, you know, and I was staying in contact with my sponsor and going to the one meeting a week that I was going to and doing the very best I could. And, you know, I never did want to drink. And, you know, at one point she asked me, she's like, have you ever thought about drinking? I'm like, no, haven't. She says, oh, man, talking to you. She says, sometimes I wonder if I don't want to drink. And I'm like, no, don't tell me that. I'm good. But anyway, so, you know, at the end of that, you know, we went back to the problem with my son, and I was starting to have to set some boundaries, and that was very difficult for me because I was afraid that he was going to leave. And I started recognizing that I had this innermost fear that I was going to die alone in a hotel room drinking myself to death. So the last thing I wanted to do was run my son off because then I would be alone. So I had set these boundaries. I was talking to my sponsor. It was about a 4-hour session, a lot of tears, a lot of emotions we worked through. And, you know, we get to the end of that, and she says, honey, I have to tell you. She says, you know what? It's okay. She says, because it takes a lot of tomatoes to make tomato paste. But you're going to have to get connected because you're going to wear me out. And I'm like, holy cow, the last thing I wanted to do is wear her out because I wanted what she has. So you know what? I started going to meetings with a vengeance. I was at 8 meetings on 4 service commitments and still working on my job and doing all the things I was doing. And I remember going over to your house one day and she's like, well, how many meetings have you been to? I'm like, 8. How many service commitments do you have? I'm like, 4. She's like, don't you still have that full-time job? And I said, yeah, I do. And she says, well, she says, don't you do those 2 part-time jobs too? And I'm like, yes. And she says, don't you still, like, take care of your house and do that type of stuff? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. And she's like, how in the heck do you find time to go to that many meetings? And I'm like, I am an alcoholic. What is wrong with you? Why would you even ask me that? Of course I'm going to be at meetings. You know, and at that moment in time, I didn't understand it. For the first time, I conceded to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. You know, and I was totally starting to get it, you know. And the one thing that was very disturbing to me at that point was, yeah, I didn't have a story. I knew I needed to be there. I knew I needed to go to meetings. I knew I needed to work the steps. But I didn't have a story. Hadn't been to jail. Hadn't lost my kids. Hadn't lost a home. Hadn't lost my job. You know, I didn't have a story. Craziest thing happened. Started going to meetings. And I started finding out I had a story. You know, the more I went to meetings, the more I felt comfortable, the more I had a place to be. People would call on me to talk in a meeting. I remember specifically, they were talking in a meeting about one subject that goes through a lot of our minds. You know, that time when you think about killing yourself. And, You know, I got called on to share, and, you know, I didn't even really know this was true, but it came out of my mouth. I said, you know, there are a lot of times I thought about killing myself, but I would probably mess it up. I messed up a one-night stand. If you can mess up a one-night stand, you are probably not going to kill yourself, right? You know, and I was like, holy cow, the fifth step tells me, you know, the fifth step specifically says we tell God, another person, and ourselves. I just told 50 people that, you know. I was like, holy cow. Started realizing I was a blackout drunk, you know. We had these rules at the end of my drinking, the men that we were going to date. They had to have their own teeth, their own hair, and a job. You know, we started going around. We're in our 30s about that time. We're starting to find out some bald-headed men are pretty good-looking. So they still had to have their own teeth and a job, you know. Ended up breaking my knee. I got dropped in a bar dancing. He was drunk, thought he shouldn't get me, so I tried to help myself. And I wasn't drunk, obviously. I ended up with a broken knee, and he was fine. But met the emergency room nurse when I was there, and you know, this might be true love because he even saw me cute and he still thought I was cute. So when we started dating, he knew our roles. Me and my girlfriend had talked about him often. You know, we were all in this love fest and everything, and all this was great. You know, here I was hobbling on crutches, going out to the bar still, but I had a nurse now. So we got 3 weeks into this or so. You know, I went to bring him coffee in the morning, knocked on the bathroom door, and he turned around and said hello, and his teeth were not in his mouth, let me tell you. I mean, you know, I wasn't drunk at that time, you know, and he saw me, well, but I had bad teeth, you know, and I'm like, oh, honey, it's fine. Well, we went out a few weeks later, and, you know, I don't remember much about that night. In fact, I remember nothing except the next morning when I woke up, he was gone, and he was pissed, and he told me I owed him an apology. And of course, being the great alcoholic I am, I told him, I don't know why you think I owe you an apology. You owe me an apology. Hung up, never heard from him again, you know, and that story came back to me about 2 years in sobriety, and I went, holy cow, you know what, I was a blackout drinker, who knew? Poor man, I probably said something about him not having any teeth. Bad, bad, bad stuff, you know. So all these things were starting to come up, and you know, I was starting to think about things that I was hearing in the program. They're talking about us being selfish and self-centered. You know what, I knew I probably was, or everybody else was, but I'll tell you, you know what, that night after I remembered that story of being a blackout drinker, you know, I had the opportunity to see exactly how selfish I was. I'm talking to the on the phone to a friend of mine, telling the story. Hey, guess what? I'm a blackout drinker. Tell him the story. I just told you everything. We're cutting up and laughing and all that. And yeah, I got a call from a lady that was struggling a lot and having a hard time not drinking. And you know, I thought, well, I'll call her right back. Well, when I got off the phone with my first friend, I called her back. She didn't answer, and I started getting a little worried. And, you know, I was like, oh, my gosh, what if she's drinking? You know, I'm just about 2 years sober now, so I'm thinking that I could save her, right? You know? So anyway, I'm like, oh, my gosh, I didn't answer the phone, and, you know, she probably needed help. So about 10 o'clock, I called her one more time, and she called me back then about 30 minutes later. We're talking, and she's telling me how she wanted to start drinking. You know, she's breaking up with her boyfriend. She found out he was cheating. She did all these horrible things. And I said, it's probably not that bad. Don't worry about it. You know, she's like, no, you don't understand. You know, I was going through his phone, and, you know, this crazy thing happened. You know, I started, like, telling her my truth and my experiences. I'm like, honey, that's not so bad. The guy I was living with was cheating on me, too, and I went in his phone, and I turned her name, instead of what her name was, I changed it to homewrecker. So that way, when she called him, that's what it said on her phone. She's like, that is messed up, you know? And I'm like, oh, yeah, and I was in his computer, and I was doing this, and I was doing that. And, you know, by the time we were done, she says, you know, I don't even feel like drinking anymore. She says, because if someone as messed up as you can stay sober, I could do it, too. And I'm like, hot damn. You know, I was excited. And then I got over and was like, holy cow, those are things I didn't think I would tell anybody. But you know, at that moment, to help her not feel alone, to help her know that I had done some crazy stuff too and I could stay sober, it didn't matter what she thought of me or what I had done. I did think I probably needed to call my sponsor. But anyway, so, you know, it was like amazing how things were starting to come about, and I found out, you know what, that I was a hopeless, helpless drunk, that I hurt a lot of people, that I was a blackout drinker, that I should have been in jail, and I wasn't. Around middle of 2015, you know what, I had this desire to do H&I work, and I really couldn't understand it. I had never been to jail. How can I relate with these people? But I really wanted to do it in such a way that it was, like, totally crazy. They didn't make it overly easy in our county to find out how to go about it. You know, they'd tell me things like, oh, well, you just need to give that application to Melanie. And I'm like, well, who's Melanie? You know, they're like, oh, you know Melanie? Like, there's one Melanie in all of, you know, Tulare County. But when I was going around, this lady introduced herself as Mel. And I'm like, are you Mel? Are you Melanie? And she's like, no, I'm not that Melanie. It's like, okay. So finally, I get this all submitted and everything. Now, you know, I'm doing all these service commitments. I'm finding out really how alcoholic I am, and I need to be here. And I get the letter to go do my fingerprints. And I'm like, oh, you know what, I'm going to be going on vacation and stuff, so I'll do that when I get back, put it in a file. Well, being the great alcoholic I am, I get back from vacation and I never go through that file. You know, that's what I'm going to do one of these days. And then I get a letter from the county and they said, well, you know what, when you're going to take your application out of the pile if you don't go get your fingerprints. You know, it's amazing how you can find shit and go do it when you know your ass is on the line. So about the only time I ever move real quickly when things are, like, to the wire. So I went down, I got my fingerprints, started out in training, started going to jail. What an awesome experience. Absolutely, positively awesome. You know, I came to find out from going to jail with those ladies, you know what, I did live in prison. It was the size of a Jack Daniels bottle. And it was getting smaller and smaller because I couldn't afford it. I didn't lose my kids to CPS, but my kids wanted nothing to do with me. They hated me. They did everything they could to stay away from me. I paid my car payment because I really thought I might end up living in it and I wanted to have a place to live. I was a really good liar about my job. I did enough to get by and to convince everybody else that I was doing okay. It took me 2.5 years to get my job really caught up when I started doing it really correctly. You know, it's amazing the delusion and the things I believed in it, you know. So still kind of dealing with that issue with my son, you know. I still couldn't get a really clear understanding on it, you know. I knew there was nothing I could do. I knew I needed to go to meetings. I needed to stay connected. You know, I talked with my sponsor about it. I'm in a lot of meetings and everything. And then that aha moment happened, that spiritual awakening we all wait for. You know, I'm sitting there in Bridge Street one morning, and a gentleman that goes there every morning at 7, like every morning, I call him my angel because he always said something that I needed to hear, and I absolutely love being around him. He told a story that morning, you know, and he was talking about a son that always got in trouble, and the dad was always bailing him out. And after he bailed him out and bailed him out and bailed him out, you know, he finally decided that, you know what, the son was an adult, that he had done what he was supposed to do. And he prayed to God and said, God, that's your son. He said, you need to take him back. So when the police came for the son the next time, he said, you know what, that's not my son, that's God's son. And the police says, well, no, you need to come out and you need to get him. He says, that's not my son, that's God's son. And he got out of the way, and years later, the son came back and said, hi, Dad, how have you been? And at that moment in time, it all made sense for me. You know what, I had done everything I could possibly do for my son. I did the best that I could do. I took him and got his surgeries and gave him the best possible chance at life. What he's going through, I don't understand any more than he understands alcoholism. I've done my job. My job now is to love and support him. It's not my journey. It's his journey. And my job is to support him. And I was like, holy cow, you know what? This is, like, incredible. Like, everything made sense. The light bulb came on. It was that whole ta-da moment, you know. And I wanted to laugh. I wanted to cry. I wanted to tell somebody. I knew they wouldn't understand. And so at lunchtime, I went home and I called my sponsor and I said, I think I had a spiritual awakening. And I told her everything I just told you. And we talked through it. And she says, yeah, you know, then I would say that's a spiritual awakening, and, you know, it kind of puts you in a new dimension of living. And I said, yes, it does, and I don't ever want to do it again. And she says, well, why is that? And I said, that was way too many emotions, way too fast. I don't ever want to go through that again. And just like that, she's like, well, think about it as an orgasm, spiritual orgasm. I'm like, oh, you know what? I would do that again. And I love that sponsor. She always found out ways to make it exciting, you know. And so we continued on, and, you know, things kind of fell into place. And, you know, she's taught me a lot in this program, and I've learned a lot from other people. I'm going to leave you with this. You know, she reminds me often that the steps protect me from me. the traditions protect AA from me. There's a lot of times I'll need staff and too, you know. I have to practice a lot of humility and understanding that, you know what, I am just a person. I am so incredibly blessed to be sober today. It's a gift that I don't want to waste, ever. You know, she reminds me that to think about the steps is the dance around the playground. And you know what, if I do that, the most amazing thing happens, because that fence might be around the playground, but there's no top. So there's no limit to how high it could go. That's all based on my connection to a higher power. I try to keep this program very simple today. You know, I'm very blessed to have a couple ladies that have asked me to take them through the steps, and I try to break it down really easy. It's like, okay, you know what? It's not so hard. You know what? You have a disease. The disease is going to kill you. Alcohol is your higher power. You don't have any choices. You're not doing the things you do because you want to do them. You're doing it because you're sick. I loved that part when my sponsor explained that to me. I wasn't so happy about the part that you had to clean up that mess, you know. I was like, well, if I didn't create it, it was the disease. Well, I don't have to clean it up, you know. And she reminded me of one of the most important things. You know what? When they write a whole chapter on it in the big book, that's one you got to read. You know, and there's a whole chapter on the family afterward, you know. That's what you got to read. So, you know, it's been an incredible journey today. You know what, I haven't had a drink in 5.5 years. Today I know that I don't have to drink today. Relapse doesn't have to be part of my story. That as long as I have a connection to a higher power, that I'm okay. As long as I don't forget what I am, I'm an alcoholic. I don't have to lose who I am. And that's a blessing. I come to meetings often because I need to be reminded of my yets, recognize my truths, and get the opportunity to believe in the possibilities. Not like around and some of the people I met today that haven't drank in 28 years, 30 years, you know what? That's incredible to find out that's possible. So today I try to keep it really easy. You know what? This program to me is the fact that all I have to do is believe in the impossible and it becomes possible. And I just have to do it. So thank you all for letting me share. Thank you all for showing me the possibilities of life today. And I love all of you. Thank you.